while the plus.
Wow. Good evening, good morning, or good day. We've been trying to get in this room all day, and we've all been busy. Mr. Chair, so I think maybe, and I apologize we didn't post this stuff, Mr. Chair, we saw each other, and you have a list of provisions. Actually, I don't have it back over there, but that's okay. I don't need it. I think we're waiting for some copies. I don't know. But we have a list, too. And
well, Madam Chair, I just think it's good if we start putting things on a piece of paper that we need to talk about so we can get ourselves ready and try to work through these things. And
so right.
We just have a list of stuff we think is important. And I know you've got a list. And
yep. So I was hoping, I don't know how late we want to stay. I know people have to do things like have governors come to their districts and go fishing with them. And so there's things that people have to do. No, it's an honor. Aren't you lucky? Yes. So we had scheduled that we wanted to talk about our property tax relief for individuals and both homeowners and renters, and we wanted to talk about our alcohol provision. And we're hoping that we can maybe start some of these little ones, too, or at least get them in front of everyone so that tomorrow there's a big list. And so what I did is I asked our staff to, and I think they've shared it with the Senate Council, but I don't know about that. No. I asked our staff to go through all the lists that the two sides have had from the very first list we had, and then we've had these technical things, and comb them and put on one sheet of paper all the things we haven't gotten to yet that we keep saying we're going to, plus new ones. And so that's getting copied right now. And then simultaneously, we have this one. And some of them are on both lists. Those are the blue marks. So I think there's no way we're going to get through these two lists tonight, but at least we'll have two new lists of things.
But Madam Chair, some of them are very simple, and they're not very simple.
Mm-hmm.
The length of the list, I don't think.
Right. It might in ours.
Well, not on this list.
Yeah. So if we can get started on our list, and we'll get that other one passed out when it gets here, and that is to talk about property tax relief. And we know both of us have local government aid and county program aid, and we don't. I know that the Senate has some renters credit, so we can hear the differences, but we want to talk about what the Senate does not have, which is increased individual homeowner property tax payments for relief for homeowners as opposed to renters,
sure.
Direct payments. So Representative Dabney is going to tell us about that, and we've got some handouts, and they should be coming around here as soon as Ms. Jensen returns.
And, Madam Chair, I think it'll be timely because much of the education discussion we had in the Senate provision is property tax relief. Much of the money is going toward that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this will be real timely and fit in with the discussion that we had of last night.
Yes, great. Thank you. And I don't know where. I'm going to just walk over. I think her handouts are.
I have a group of them.
There's a group of them here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, the House really emphasized individual property tax relief as an important part of our package this year. House File 2 changes to the property tax refund program. It's the homestead credit program now under House File 677. It does a number of things. Like your bill, it does enhance the renter's credit because we recognize that renters pay property taxes just as homeowners do. But we also heard a lot on the campaign trail from homeowners.
Yes.
As our candidates were knocking on doors this last fall, a number of issues on the table last fall, but property taxes was a big one. I don't think Senate candidates had any different experience than the House candidates did on that. So we focused on enhancing and expanding the property tax refund program, but then also went beyond that. So we not only reformed the structure of the program, but we also emphasized outreach. And what the Department of Revenue can tell you now is somewhere between 60 and 70% of the homeowners who qualify for what's now the Homestead Credit Refund Program in the House bill take it, meaning somewhere between 30 and 40% of folks who qualify for a refund under the state program don't take it. So we not only enhanced the property tax refund program to reach more people. We estimate 100,000 more Minnesotans will get increased refunds from that. Average refund will increase by $212 for homeowners across the state. But then we also direct the counties and the Department of Revenue to share information, because each of them has a piece, but they've got to share it to make it work, to then reach out to homeowners and connect with them and say, you know, you qualify for a refund. You didn't apply for it. Here's how to apply for the new Homestead Credit Refund Program. So we really wanted to see money getting back in the pockets of Minnesotans based on income and the amount of income that then goes to property taxes. We reduced those thresholds. We did some other technical changes. I think maybe similar to some of the changes that you did in the renter's credit program. We also matched at least similar provisions.
We just did the governor's.
Okay. Okay. But we also wanted to connect with Minnesotans, make sure they knew they were eligible. Oddly enough, to the way I think, Department of Revenue estimates that only about half the people we contact and tell them there's a check waiting for you at the Department of Revenue in St. Paul will actually take the state up on that opportunity. Thank you.
Representative Davenny, nice that you do recognize the problems in the PTR, and that is that such a large number of people, even though they qualify, don't participate. That's one of the reasons that we've always kind of not had a lot of support for it.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members are getting a couple of handouts. The one on the direct property tax relief to renters walks through the decrease in income threshold that we did. Representative Morgan really stressed wanting to make sure that this relief got to the folks who would most be stressed by the property taxes that were part of their rent. And what we recognize is post-recession, more folks are renting, and so the rental market is tightening up. Some of those certainly were people who lost their homes from foreclosure. Some of those are people who might want to move into home ownership but have not been able to secure mortgages over the last couple of years when lending regulations or lending requirements tightened up. And 5 years ago, they might have qualified for a mortgage. Today, they don't because of changes in the banks. And you can see 50,000 of the renters across the state, about 15%, will get bigger refunds. As you know, I'm sure, Mr. Chair, a lot of this goes to the elderly and disabled in the communities because of the structure of the program, and we like that. 66,000 of the renters across the state would get bigger refunds, and about 10,000 more renters would become eligible for the program under our change. And then you can see some of the changes that we made on the other sheet on the schedule, where we decreased the thresholds of how much income is reflected in property taxes to make more folks eligible. On the property tax for relief for homeowners, the Homestead Credit Refund, again, decreasing the thresholds so that we make more people eligible and enhance the refunds that they get. We do something interesting here in trying to incent Minnesotans to save for their retirement. And we do some changes in how we account for contributions to retirement programs, IRAs, 401Ks, 403Bs, things like that, as a way to get a hurdle out of Minnesotans' way and encourage them to save for their retirement. By changing the thresholds, about 75% of the current recipients will get bigger refunds, and about 116,000 more homeowners will become eligible, with, as I said, an average increase in their refund of about $212. To me, that's real money. And as we know, it's real money that usually hits in the fall when folks are out buying clothes for the kids or looking for a new pair of boots for the winter that's coming on, things like that. And the notification program that we established between counties and the department, the Minnesotans should reach out to about 200,000 more Minnesotans, and about 100,000 of those would be expected to participate. So we think this is a strong program that provides, gets more Minnesotans involved and engaged, gets more Minnesotans some property tax relief, and enhances the programs, makes them more progressive so they're more responsive to incomes of middle and working class Minnesotans.
Mr. Chair and Senate conferees, I do want to just say the amount of work that Representative Dabney and Representative Lean and all kinds of folks put into really trying to think through how to get middle-class property tax relief returned. And you know, what was really driving the House here, and we support and value local government aid, whether we represent communities that receive it or not. We support and are funding county program aid. But we also think individuals should have property tax relief, and we have that. Without casting aspersions on anyone, as the governor has said, people, sometimes have to agree to things that they didn't really support. I mean, I think we all know the governor, it was not his initiative to eliminate the homestead credit. Yet it's gone. $538 million that program cost a biennium, and there were some problems as it flowed through cities. And so, people have said that was never funded. I think we all know that's not accurate. It was almost mostly funded most of the time. And in fact, a number of us know that some of the reasons that some of the communities didn't get some of the market value credit money through the cities, where the cities got shorted, the individual got the money, it wasn't a fair way to do it, and then we left the cities on the hook to either raise taxes or cut services. It was a way to make the wealthy suburbs contribute when everybody else was getting their LGA cut. So these were often runs done that said, we're going to have the wealthy suburbs chip in here because we can't cut their LGA because they don't get it. So there's been sort of a misrepresentation, I think, in my mind by those who wanted to eliminate that program by what was really going on there. Having said that, I think the cities have made a really good argument that this kind of backdoor deal where you give it to the people but then, you short the city afterward, they're right about that. And so we didn't want to do that, but we wanted to bring back the homestead credit that the relief that people got under that. And that's what this bill is doing, and it's doing it directly. There's no, the cities and counties aren't being asked to lose it. People forget, and I know Senator Scoy, you care about the school funding, and even in the years when the cities lost a little of the homestead credit, the schools never lost a dollar ever in Minnesota history. The schools never lost the value of the homestead credit once, not a dollar, and yet it was completely eliminated last year, all of it, gone. So it was a $500 million plus program. I think what Representative Dabney has here is to take that same homestead credit relief that our homeowners are receiving. 95% of homeowners received this relief. And now saying, okay, so we're going to take the cities, the flowing through the cities and counties and the school districts out of it, and we're going to target that relief that was provided by the homestead credit into the circuit breaker system. And so we're really committed to that. I mean, if you take a look at this, I think Representative Dabney's described it well. I mean, it's pretty compelling. 75% of current filers who get their, file for the property tax refund would get a bigger refund. That's 315,000 homeowners, and another 116,000 homeowners would become eligible who aren't. And you can see the average refund will increase $212, and this is really, in total, 530,000 homeowners would benefit. This is, that's really, at its core, our attempt to bring back that property tax relief that was lost when folks weren't willing to raise taxes. you know, that's really what was driving all this. I mean, we have to remember that. It wasn't that people didn't believe in homeowner property tax relief. And so I think we feel strongly that a package of assisting cities, assisting counties, assisting schools must have renters, which you have. And I know you want to tell us about your program because you have a healthy program too. But we also want the homeowners to receive the loss of the homestead credit. And so I think, you know, if you go through the details, very compelling, and, you know, trying to target within renters and homeowners, assistance to those who need it most. And so if you kind of go through the thresholds, I mean, you still have on the renter's credit, you know, we think it's reasonable that if you're down at a 1% threshold, there's probably not an argument for a big change. You know, it's sort of attempting our best effort to return those losses. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, we too have concerns about the property tax changes that occurred, recognizing that, as you talked about, much of the impact from the homestead credit not funding didn't fall on many of the rural communities because they had LGA, which was cut first. And that was the way the law was structured. And so when the homestead market value credit elimination occurred, it hit particularly hard on those provisions because they hadn't seen the reductions. And so I think that in my, you know, my memory is, as I said earlier, good, but the recall kind of not so good. So, and I'm doing this from memory. I've checked that Mr. Paulson, he doesn't have his stuff here, but we'll try to get it. You know, when the homestead market value credit was eliminated, I think it was 60% of that money that was saved was coming out of the rural areas because that's where LGA flows mostly. And it was, you know, and then they did the value exclusion on homes. And the small businesses on some of our community's main streets and the ag land, that's what was left to pick up the exclusion. And we had significant property tax increases in those classes of properties. And so when I spent a fair amount of time this session trying to figure out if there was some mechanism to utilize to address all of the impacts that occurred without just restoring the homestead market value credit, because I think we recognize that that wasn't the perfect program either. I finally came around to the conclusion that the best way to get at this was just to attack the levies. And so LGA gets levy relief and county program aid and the school levy relief. And so that's kind of where I went, a little bit different than this. Part of the reason that I'm a little uncomfortable with the PTR is, you know, there's been pretty significant growth in that program in the last number of years. And I think, and we'll get the data, but I think it's almost 70% of the money that's in the PTR program or the expansion of the PTR program flows into the metropolitan area. And so we eliminated the homestead market value credit where 60% of the savings occurred from dollars that used to go to rural Minnesota, and now we're proposing to replace it with a program that 30% of the money goes to the rural areas. And that is a little problematic, but, you know, we're going to take a look at this, and I think we're pretty close on the renter's credit. I think we both recognize the importance of a strong program there, and we just tracked along with the governor's proposal, but, you know, if you've got some improvements to it, we certainly are open and interested in looking at those.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, and I hear that.
I forget who's chairing today. I think you are.
I think I am. Yeah. Mr. Chair, you know, just to respond to that, because I've heard that same sort of critique, and I will tell you that, you know, if we were putting $538 million into this program, maybe the distribution would be different.
Yeah.
But we're not. This program, and the reason the returning that Representative Dabney is doing of the homestead credit benefit is so important to us. First of all, it is the most progressive thing in the Minnesota tax system. There is nothing more progressive than this program. Simultaneously, indeed the Senate at a much bigger level than the House, but all three, Senate, Governor, and House, when you look at where income taxes are going to be levied at the end of the day, they're disproportionately coming from another part of the state. You know, geographically. And most of the aids, this is one, you know, a direct homestead credit, renter's credit, LGA, CPA, school aid as proposed by the Senate, disproportionately in total benefit greater Minnesota, and the income tax increase comes from another part of Minnesota. So seems fair to me that the folks across the state, based on their ability to pay, the fact that they happen to reside in the metro is irrelevant in this formula. It says if you earn these things, we don't care if you live in Eveleth or Rochester or New Hope or Stillwater. If you're in this income and your property tax is this burden, you get relief. And we're silent on where you reside. What we're trying to do, and that's why it's so progressive, is give people relief based on the ability to pay. And so where that dollar falls, we don't know it. It turns out that it is as you've said, and that's accurate. But it is one of the few things that's progressive. I mean, we've got the income and the income tax in Minnesota, and we've got the estate tax. But other than renter's credit and property tax, the circuit breaker system, it's pretty hard to find. You know, LGA is not progressive. Mm-hmm. I mean, county programming is not progressive. So, you know, it seems to me that if you fall in these areas, you ought to, get some help here. And I know the commissioner's not here tonight, but this is the moment for the three-legged stool that he should be here for, because we all know what's been happening in property taxes in this state for 10 years, and we are shifting the burden there. And these are the programs that provide some relief as people refuse to look at more revenue. We've seen everything get pushed in the property tax system. And I've always felt, you know, if I represent a widow who lives on Social Security and has been paying more in her property taxes than she ever paid yearly in her mortgage, ever. And I really shouldn't care if she lives in Bloomington or in Hibbing, because that person is struggling, and that's what this brings in. You know, you have to, these formulas work to say it's your income related to your property taxes. And after some threshold that you have to pay yourself, and quite frankly, some of greater Minnesota doesn't hit the threshold because they don't pay a lot in property taxes in certain parts of the state. I don't think this was ever in any way intended to be something for the metro. It's something intended for people with lower incomes, with large property tax burdens, and it doesn't intend to pick out where those people are, and if some years they fall disproportionately in certain parts of the state, it's really income driven. So I hope you can hear it that way, because we really aren't intending to do that. So
Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair. And we are particularly pleased with the outreach component, because I think that, you know, certainly the first thing we ought to do is, you know, get them utilizing the current program. I mean, if it's only, I don't remember what Representative Dabney said, 60% of the people or somewhere around that are utilizing what's there, I think it's important to outreach and get people to utilize what's there. And it's just, only makes sense.
Other questions on Representative Dabney's work? I really hope you will consider this as part of a package. The great thing is the House and the Senate and the Governor are committed to property tax relief, so we know we're going to do something, and until we get a target, we don't know how it'll look, but we hope you'll consider it. So if we're done with that, we can go to alcohol. That didn't sound so well.
Oh, Madam Chair, I actually was thinking that when you went to alcohol, I would hit the road. And
Madam Chair, it's Friday night.
So I
road
think,
trip?
Yes, exactly. Okay. So on the alcohol item, I think I'm going to ask Mr. Biggerstaff, didn't see him there, and I don't know if Mr. Michael is part of this too or who, but if they want to join us, I know there's nobody on the other side because you're not proposing that, but if they can join us at the table. But, you know, I'll just start by saying I just want to talk a little bit about the alcohol tax. I mean, we all know what an alcohol tax is, and there's a couple taxes that we could have picked from, right? the gross receipts or the excise. They both have their pluses and minuses, both politically and policy-wise. So we picked the excise tax. Now, you can certainly argue, you know, that's politically expedient because it's hidden, because how, where the tax falls. We took a long look at both of them, and we picked it because it hasn't been raised in 26 years. Seemed pretty reasonable. The charges that people are saying about the alcohol tax are, you know, disappointing, I will say that. But, you know, when you're doing percentages of zero or percentages of 1 cent, it's very easy to claim they're a 600% increase and not really explain the equation that walks you through why, if you go from 1 cent to 2 cents, you know. So, I mean, I hope this... these set of 10 conferees won't fall for that, that you'll just oppose, you know, alcohol taxes if that's what you're going to do on something other than sort of the game of 600%. So what is it really? I mean, it is going from 1 cent to total 8 cents. So we're adding 7 cents, yes. It's been 26 years. We tried to calculate it to make sure that, and we've got a handout on that. Maybe Ms. Jensen can hand that out. There's a few of them. We tried to make sure that we'd hit all the wine, hard liquor, and beer the same, so we really could say it's 7 cents a drink. I also want to address, you know, people are saying, well, it's not really 7 cents. There's a secret markup that's taking place. You know, it's unfortunate that people are intending to ask their customers who they claim to care about that you, while the government taxes you more, we need to go get some money out of you too. I mean, we understand that people take opportunities for a markup. But I've seen nothing, and if anybody wants to point to me in our bill where anyone is compelled to do anything other than 7 cents, you know, I don't buy that argument, and I wouldn't be carrying this in my bill if I did. But having said that, you know, the argument we really want you to think about as you go forward here, and I'm someone who drinks, and our best data says that somewhere around 90% of Minnesotans drink. Yet it's a small group of that who drink a lot. And so if you kind of go through the math on the alcohol tax, if you drink 3 drinks a week, so I don't know what everybody on these 10 conferees do and what the commissioner and the assistant commissioner and everybody does, but just think about that for a minute. If you drink 3 drinks a week, it's 21 cents. So you can kind of walk through it. You know, we're talking like $10 a year that we're going to ask folks who drink 3 drinks a week. And remember, these are discretionary purchases. This isn't like food and fuel. Because we believe that before we ask for general tax increases to cover the state costs as it relates to all the costs that surround alcohol, we ought to ask the users to pay first, just like a gas tax. I know you just got done voting on that, but it works the same way. Buy more gas, more gallons, you pay more gas tax. And you all know how that works. Same here. That's what we're doing in alcohol. So on the alcohol, if you drink, say, 4 drinks a day, I think most people understand that that's, you know, there are people who drink 4 drinks a day. It's probably $100 a year to you. And you know, we think that's fair because the alternative would be to pick up these state costs is that all of us should pay more as opposed to users who are using these things. Now, we know about 20% of people who use a lot amount of alcohol tend to be the people, it tends to be the large consumers who are costing the government through court, DWI, chemical dependency, health costs, car accidents, fatalities, whatever. And we've got that if Ms. Jensen wants to hand that out too. And we can get all into the detail, but I'm just trying to go through the narrative. So. Mm-hmm. There's a Columbia University study that looked at the cost of alcohol by a state by state, and that's a 2009 study. I don't think I brought that one. And I think they pegged Minnesota at about $2.8 billion annually for the cost of alcohol. Health-related, all related, you know, judicial, prisons, corrections, blah, blah, blah. I don't know how they figured that out. The strong advocates, I think we do have it here. The strong advocates, this is the Columbia study, the strong advocates who really want to see this passed to start, you know, paying for things that it's costing, and this is the other one. We're going to see two here. I've heard them claim, you know, $7 billion a year. You know, I'm just going with the studies. Columbia University, $2.8 billion. The Minnesota Department of Health, $5 billion. That's what it costs annually related to alcohol. So what we're looking at is a total price tag of, I think someone will correct me, $380 million or $400 million in there. So you can see how that $400 million less than doesn't hit the $5 billion in cost. And it just seems reasonable, and I think most people think it's reasonable, that if they're going to use it, you know, buy this discretionary thing, they can pay 7 cents more every 26 years to help defer some of these costs. So, you know, I understand nobody likes to pay taxes for anything, but our alternative here, because we are committed in the House, and I know the Senate is too, to raise some revenue, that we're going to have to go to some other general tax then. And we don't want to do that. I will admit before I'm told it by Senate conferees, because you'll be right, it's a very regressive tax. Yes, sirree. We know that. But it pays for a lot of progressive programming that is needed as a use of as part of the use of this product that we're all consuming. I mean, I guess there may be some people here who don't consume alcohol at this table, but I do, and I think this is reasonable. So, you know, I understand it's difficult.
And I would like to yet tonight.
Yeah. So you know, we can, you know, without having too much detail exact about it, where it's better, I think, for the Senate to hear how we're thinking about it. Mm-hmm. Just like we have those cigarette taxes, you know, that help pay some of the costs. Really, on cigarette taxes, I think the goal there is the public health of getting people to either not start or quit and then recoup. There isn't a lot of data now. Some people will say that I've seen that says raising alcohol taxes makes people drink less. That doesn't really appear to be true, except for with maybe there's some studies that show some young males there is some influence, but mostly that's not really going to happen. So we're not selling it that way. I'm not trying to sell it like, hey, let's go for this and that'll make people drink less. That's not the intent here. It's to say the fact that people are drinking, there are these $5 billion a year costs to the state of Minnesota. Let's recoup some of that in a user fee mechanism as opposed to a general tax. So that's kind of it. And I don't know if you have questions for me, if you just want to hear more detail. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering what, and I think we've seen this before, but I don't remember. The surrounding states, the comparison between the way... both the way in which Minnesota taxes, which I think in some areas is different, the way we tax is different, and then the overall impact in terms of what the total tax is based on the gallons or liters or whatever. And have that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll ask Mr. Biggerstaff to talk about that, but I'll just tell you there's no doubt that compared to the rest of the states will be a lot higher. Wisconsin has incredibly low beer taxes.
In our surrounding states, yeah.
Right. Okay. And you know, if we use that measure, for sure it's an argument against what the House is trying to do.
I was just asking for the I couldn't remember.
Right. And I think the other thing I'd say, this is true, the border cities, you know, these are always issues. There's no question, and we have border city provisions in our bill on disparity reduction aid, and we recognize that between cigarettes and alcohol, there's issues there, and we understand that. And, you know, when North Dakota passes an $800 million property tax relief bill, which they just did, right, and I think it was signed, that's pretty hard to compete with. But, you know, on the other hand, we don't have oil. So, I mean, it's, you know, I think sometimes these comparisons aren't really fair, and I know you're not saying that, Senator Rest, but I would ask Mr. Biggerstaff to, if you could, or Mr. Michael, to answer Senator Rest's questions directly on kind of the details of that. Senator Skoy?
Well, I'll wait.
Okay, Senator, or Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, unfortunately, I didn't bring my comparisons for wine and distilled spirits along, but in general, Minnesota's excise taxes are higher at their current levels. They're higher than Wisconsin. Wisconsin's an extraordinarily low tax state for any kind of alcoholic beverage. Yeah, I think you may, in fact, have that.
No, she just handed it to me.
And where, by comparison, Iowa is unique in that it has a state. It's one of the states that has a state monopoly on distilled spirits, and so it's very hard to compare Minnesota with Iowa. But
so, Mr. Michael, so in Iowa, all the liquor stores are state liquor stores?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, yes, if you
okay,
want
I understand
to buy
the concept.
Right,
yep.
And there are, I believe, 18 other states that have that pattern. And, of course, then it's sort of up to the manager to determine how much to mark it up to.
Sure. Right. I'm familiar with
but
that.
But in general, Minnesota's excise tax on wine and beer is higher than Wisconsin but lower than Iowa, South Dakota, and North Dakota. Minnesota, though, has this retail gross receipts tax, 2.5%. Of our bordering states, only North Dakota has a similar pattern to that, and their tax is 2%. Our distilled spirits tax, as you can see from the table there, is on the high side compared to South Dakota and North Dakota. This change would, of course, put us significantly above any of our surrounding states on the excise tax. Plus, we would also have the gross receipts tax. And I did. There's been mostly interest in the beer element of this, and I did print out a national comparison of where we rank on excise tax on beer compared to the other states, both before and after the change that's proposed in the House bill. And some of these comparisons are difficult to make accurately because other states have more power to give their locals to impose taxes. So, for example, Chicago and New York have local taxes. There are some southern states where they've empowered their local governments to impose taxes. And so, for example, Georgia, almost all of the local units of government in Georgia have a beer tax. And so there's a 52-cent a gallon beer tax that's imposed by almost all cities in Georgia. Huh. So those kinds of things that make the national. And, of course, people aren't, you know, beer is a very heavy commodity, and so you're not, it's not like cigarettes where you can, you know, drive, come back with a trunk full of cigarettes. It's harder to do that with beer. There are just volume restrictions that make it more difficult. But this will, the House proposed.
Mr. Michaels, not when you drive a pickup.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
This, right. But this tax increase will definitely, you know, make us on the high side nationally.
Yes.
of alcohol excise taxes.
And Senator Rest and Chair Skoy and others, you know, we've been very open about the critique and the facts. Because what's driving it in my mind in the Minnesota House, again, as someone who consumes alcohol and has not been asked to pay more in this tax for 26 years, what drives it in my mind, so it's no doubt we would be high compared to others, but this, okay, so now this one, the footnote's not on here. It's a page out of the Columbia University study. But this one's our own Minnesota Department of Health. This is not, it was not done for this bill. This is something the Minnesota Department of Health. And so if I can just, you know, say, just if you just take a look at this, for the most recent year available, the economic costs associated with alcohol use are an estimated $5.06 billion. That's a year. This amounts to over $975 for every person in this state. These costs are 17 times greater than the $296 million in current tax revenues collected. And so just for, you know, to think about this a little bit, so it's talking about, it mentions things like what, how many deaths are related to excessive alcohol consumption and how many fatalities. But, you know, just to tick off a few here, unintentional injuries, including falls, burns, drowning, motor vehicle crashes, violent acts, including homicide, suicide, assault, chronic diseases, including cancer, digestive disease, cardiovascular disorder, unintended pregnancy, sexually transmitted diseases, alcohol-related birth defects. Now, I think we can all think about some of them like, hey, you know, that's not really fair because not everybody who drinks does these things or whatever. But there's, you know, the issue of how do we all sort of contribute to paying for this stuff. It's a user fee as opposed to a general tax. I mean, I think some of them, they're pretty hard to get away from, though. So take fetal alcohol syndrome, for example. You know, that's really only caused by one thing. It's drinking during pregnancy. And there's costs that we all pay in higher taxes to pay to service those families and those children for the rest of their lives. So, you know, we're really being driven here on the cost on the state side as a package of both progressive and regressive taxes, and we're not hiding from that. But we hope at the end of the day, I know people feel strongly about this generally, one way or another. They're really against it or they're really for it. But I think every 26 years, it's worth a look, and we hope the Senate will be willing to be a little open-minded to it. So. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know who's best to answer the questions, but I'm just trying to
And I understand the people who are making a worst-case scenario about the multiplier effect and all that, and I understand I'm not buying into all of that. But I do want to get my head around just kind of what kind of percent increase we are looking at in real terms, you know. And I can get a 12-ounce beer is $2.50, and, you know, I can guess a glass of wine. But when you look at these barrel liter, you know, numbers in this graph that I'm looking at, so the per liter barrel, per barrel or liter of 3.2 or this is 2.40, and per drink is 1 cent, 25.50. So what's a barrel of this stuff cost? So what kind of percentage increase are we talking about? Does anybody have any idea on that?
Yeah, we've got
I just
that.
Don't, you know?
And Mr. Bayerstaff, I think it might be on this sheet that was created, but I should have said this is a House research document, as is this. Is the barrel item on here, Mr. Biggerstaff? Or if you could give it to us.
Just
I think it's on
kind
here.
Of help me understand what we're looking at and, for percentage increases.
And maybe if you could tell for the record, you know, the small brewers and the small grape growers and stuff are exempt, which is also a lot people don't understand. We're not taxing them. An increase because
so
how we're changing, and we can walk through that,
sure,
the minimum
sure.
and maximum gallon.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
you know, we're open to hearing the Summit and Shell, some change, you know, trying to get, we tried to do some calculation to try to get them in, but at that time it was, the cost on the spreadsheet was just, it was too great. But Mr. Biggerstaff, if you could answer Senator Scoy on that, and then also talk a little bit about who's exempt really here. There's been a lot of misunderstanding about
and
that, too.
Madam Chair,
yes,
for the
Mr.
exemptions, if you could tie them into the current law definition of a small winery and a farm brewer, I think they're like 50,000 barrels or whatever it is. If you could give us some information on all of that when you're talking about the caps.
Madam Chair and Senator Scoy, as far as your first question regarding the percentage change, it's going to depend on what you're talking about at the retail level, because, for instance, a barrel of beer is 31 gallons, and, you know, a lower quality beer by the barrel might cost $100, but a higher quality beer might cost $250. So the percentage at the retail level, a $2.50 beer versus a $5 beer, I mean, the excise tax will still be the same because it's still the same volume. It's still a 12-ounce glass of beer.
So, Madam Chair, so the tax is the same on the barrel of beer, irrespective of whether it's Miller Lite or
not linked to price.
Or Surly Furious.
Right. It's so
really.
On the excise tax, think about like the gas tax. You know, Minnesotans often think that when the price of gas goes up, they pay more gas tax, and they don't. You know, if it's $1 a gallon of gas or $100 a gallon of gas, it's the same tax. The same concept here. It's a volume tax. So if the price is going up and down, that's not changing the tax. Is that a fair representation, Mr. Biggerstaff?
Madam Chair, members, that's correct. The only difference would be between there's two types of beer. There's the 3.2 beer and the strong beer. The total excise tax on a barrel of 3.2 beer would be slightly lower than on a barrel of strong beer, and that's the way that it is under current law. They're both raised by the same amount, so it's still 7 cents regardless of whether. Roughly 7 cents, regardless of whether it's a barrel of strong beer or 3.2 beer.
Mr. Chair.
And Madam Chair, I don't know if anybody even has the answers, can speculate on this, but would it be more progressive if it was based on the value as opposed to the volume?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, Representative Clark has tried to get at that in the past. She's had bills where she tried to pick, you know, expensive wines and tax them. And it just, it's, you know, Mr. Michael or Mr. Biggerstaff might want to talk about how you do that, because we're open to different ways of doing things. It's hard to do. It sounds like Senator Ress knows the complications that get there. And then
there's there in 87.
Okay. And, you know, it's hard to know, quite honestly. You know, people assume that people have stereotypes about how low-income people drink and how wealthy people drink that really aren't very accurate, quite frankly. There's a lot of people with a lot of resources who are buying, you know, the same beer as the person with the lower income, and there's people who, you know, like a good bottle of scotch and save up for it and maybe have a low income, and, you know, so, you know, it's hard to make those parallels. But if you want to tell us how you drink, we want to know.
Well, no, Madam Chair, but I do want to tell you my cheap beer story.
Okay.
And I had a six-pack of beer bet with a friend of mine, and I won. And so I was going to Paul, and I was saying, well, when am I going to get paid off my six-pack of beer? And he said, well, I just haven't got it quite ready for you, but I am getting it ready. And this was in Christmas time, New Year's time, and somewhere in March I was over to his house, and he said, oh, I've got your six-pack of beer. So we went down into the furnace room, and he took the six-pack of Keystone Light off the top of the wood stove and said, here's your six-pack of beer. For those of you that are of my vintage, Keystone was the first company to put a plastic liner inside their can to keep the beer from getting the metal flavor. And it all melted, of course. That's quite a cheap beer story.
So,
but I did win the bet.
So if you walk into a liquor store and you buy a cheap 12-pack, what would a cheap 12-pack of beer be right now? Relatively inexpensive. I don't know. But if you buy...
7-8.
How much?
7-8.
I don't drink beer anymore after that.
My husband drinks Summit, and he buys them by the 12-pack, and I think it's about $10. I could be wrong on that. Because he usually does the liquor store run.
Yeah.
$12? $12? What is it? $14. Okay, $14. So if he picks up the $14 12-pack of Summit, or he picks up, you know, a Shell's or an Old Milwaukee or, you know, something that's, you know, $25 a 12-pack, the tax is the same. 7 cents on the 12 bottles. 84 cents. Tax would be the same, no matter what you're buying.
Sure.
I guess, Senator Ressa, just wondering if you have thoughts on if you can mix these things around, because we're really open. I just think it's hard to try to make it a progressive tax. What are your thoughts on all this alcohol?
I don't think you can. And I think that's the dilemma. It's going to be continue to be regressive.
Mm-hmm.
And... which is why it's not changed, or obviously not here in a very long time, just like some of the other things, but it's why.
Yeah. So we struggled with that, and we know that there's a political unfairness or a political benefit to politicians that I just want to be acknowledged, that an excise tax says, you know, it's going to work this way in the volume, the gross receipts is sort of, and it sort of hides what's going on before you walk out to the till. I think that some of the industry would prefer gross receipts because it's clear to the consumer that the tax is added at the cash register. So, I mean, there's a lot of pluses and minuses in all these, and there's a good list on both sides, but, you know, we just want to have a little recouping of the state cost with use of alcohol.
Sure. And Madam Chair, mm-hmm. and probably Mr. Biggerstaff, am I pronouncing that right?
Biggerstaff, yeah.
Biggerstaff. So when I'm thinking about the percent increase, and just so I got to hear, if you're at 7 cents a can of beer and the six-pack is $5, well, let me use $7 because it's easier math, then it's 1%. 42 cents on 7. That's okay.
On the
six-pack.
Yeah.
So 420, six-pack, 42 cents would be a 10% if there was such a thing as a – I don't know if there is or not. And so when we get to the wine, it's going to be six drinks in a bottle. I don't know, whatever it is.
It's on here.
So you're looking at, again, 42 cents on a bottle of wine. Am I thinking about that right?
It's on the bottom of this sheet.
Yeah, well, I've
331 drinks – in a barrel of beer, and 6.65 ounce glasses in a bottle of wine, and 22 1.5 ounce shots in a bottle of hard liquor.
And so do you multiply those kind of by 7 and then calculate it into the price of the bottle to get my percentage? Is that
Mr. accurate? Biggerstaff?
Madam Chair and Senator Scoy, that's correct. So it's 7 cents, and we're assuming that a drink, a beer is 12 ounces, a glass of wine is 5 ounces. Mm-hmm. And drink of liquor is 1.5 ounces. Mm-hmm. So it would be 7 cents per sort of serving. And so you take however many, 6 12-ounce beers times 7 cents would be the total excise tax on a six-pack of beer.
Okay.
So Senator Scoy, I mean, one way to think about it, if the 10 of us went out to dinner, or 9 of us, because 9 of us went out to dinner, what would that cost?
Depends on where we went.
So Let's say it's $25 a person.
White Castle on rice.
So we're at $225. Let's say we're $225 for dinner, for each $25 a person, and then we drink. How much would we drink?
Am I driving up fishing tomorrow or not?
I honestly don't know. But I mean, so let's say we go out to, and it's a $300 tab. I mean, the tax increase as proposed in the bill is, you know, a couple bucks, if that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess we'd have to do the calculation. So if you drink three drinks, 21 cents. If you have four, I don't know what you have. It's 28 cents. If you're driving, zero or one. You know, I mean, so, you know, I mean, I'm just trying to get the scale of really how people mm-hmm. consume this. This isn't buying your groceries. I mean, it is a discretionary purchase. So, you know, I understand it's difficult, but it's important. The House is very strong, believes in that this is, it's the right time to do this. And
but, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair.
I mean, it might be fair to say it's between a 5% and 10% price increase, probably kind of in the range. Would that be fair? Am I thinking about this right?
I'll ask Mr. Michael and Mr. Biggerstaff to respond. I mean, because they, you know, they do have the domestic or the gross receipts and the sales tax, and there's a lot of taxes going on there.
Yeah, I did a 42 cents out of a 420 six pack for 10, and then I did $1.54, 7 cents on 22 drinks for a $20 bottle of booze. I mean, I don't know what that is. That would
it
be.
Seems, Mr. Biggerstaff?
Seem right.
Madam Chair and Senator Scoy, it would, again, depend on the value of the product. Yeah. So a lower priced product, it would be a higher overall increase. And as opposed to a, you know, $100 bottle of scotch or something like that, it's going to be, because it's the same increase on a $10 bottle of scotch and a $100 bottle of scotch, the percentage would be obviously much higher on the lower value
sure.
product.
But if it was a $20 bottle of booze and it's got 22 drinks and it's 7 cents a drink, that's $1.54.
Yes.
So if it was $15.40, it would be 10%. If it's $20, it's going to be 7% or something like
yes.
that.
Yes.
So I'm just getting my head squared to thinking about it. Okay, good. Thank you.
Anything else? If not, oh.
No,
just okay. Keep I'm sorry. Up. Representative Dabney, you have something, then we'll go to the list.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Quite all right. As we just reviewed, one of the things we do is recognize that the craft brewing industry and the small wineries, I think, isn't it Senator Stumpf?
Oh.
Oh, yeah, I talked to him. He's
pretty exempt.
Small. He said he doesn't, not much interested in this, actually.
He's exempt. Yeah.
Because of the exemption for small.
See, could we talk about the exemption briefly?
Yes.
Well, why don't we do that?
Okay, sure. Yes.
Madam Chair and members, if you want to take a look, the language for the exemption is on page 25 of the side-by-side.
Side-by-side, sorry.
Madam Chair, while we're finding that,
the first 50,
these exemptions...
Can you use your microphone?
And tax credits. They're part of just a general proposal, or are they just linked to the increase in the taxes?
Mr. Biggerstaff, could you hear that? I think of them as part of the whole alcohol tax package.
Okay. They're not independent of the raising of the tax,
no.
is what I'm asking.
No.
Yes.
Mr. Biggerstaff.
Madam Chair, members, so section 13 on page 25 of the side-by-side goes through the small winery credit. This provides a credit to a qualified winery, which is defined as any winery that produces less than 100,000 gallons of wine per year in the calendar year preceding when they apply for the credit. The credit applies to the first 50,000 barrels that they produce at a rate of $2.08 per gallon, which is the proposed tax on the wine. It's a non-refundable credit, so it would either be the taxpayer's tax liability or $104,000, which is the maximum credit.
That makes
sense. And then section 14 is the beer excise tax. It's similar to the winery credit. It applies for a qualified brewer which is a brewer who brews less than 200,000 gallons of beer in the calendar year preceding when they apply for the credit. It's a credit in the amount of the tax rate, so it depends on whether it's strong beer or 3-2 beer. And Again, it applies to the first 50,000 barrels with a maximum credit of $1,387,500, or the taxpayer's actual tax liability if it's lower.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think what we're trying to do with the exemptions and the credits for the small producers is protect these particularly small emerging businesses. I think Minneapolis now has 7 breweries. You've got 4 or 5 in your district. I've got one in at least one in mine. I think there's 7 and maybe 2 more on the way, something like that. I'm getting some nods. One piece that we didn't contemplate is, because it's only starting in the state, is micro distillers. Just as we have very small breweries now and we're trying to protect that emerging business, we've got one commercial small distiller in the state, Panther, and I'm not even sure where they're located. And there's apparently they drink a lot in southeast Minneapolis. Well, in northeast. Okay, that answers that question. culture and tradition runs deep.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney, we used to have a vodka distiller in the state, Shakers.
Yes, you did. Yes, and unfortunately they've gone out of business.
Yeah.
Didn't they produce ethanol on the side, or did they produce vodka on the side?
Yeah, one way or the other.
Yeah,
I'm not exactly sure which had the bigger gallons.
And could they substitute for each other?
Well, I don't know if the car would run on vodka or not, but I'm pretty sure the drinks wouldn't be good on the ethanol.
Yeah, right. Anyways, I've been approached by folks representing, I think they call themselves the Micro Distillers Guild. There's about 12 folks across the state, Duluth, across Minnesota, looking for an exemption for themselves to allow this new business to develop. It's very popular in other states. It's very new here. We didn't think about it because it's intended as a wholesale credit, but Mr. Michael was able to figure it out, and he can catch me if I'm wrong here. Both the House and the Senate omnibus liquor bills allow these folks to provide tastes at their distilleries. The House allows a 15 milliliter taste of their production, and the Senate a 45 milliliter taste. We would tax them on the value of those free tastes.
Field trip.
But you're going to tax the free taste?
Mr. Michael, I don't know if can you. Correct me, it was a bit of a mystery you had to chase down.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, that's the way the excise taxes work. If you produce and possess in Minnesota and you're not intending to export it or get, you know, somehow that it's otherwise exempt, you will owe the tax on that even though you're not selling it for compensation. Selling it is not a factor in whether you owe the tax liability. And so normally these micro distilleries, if they're selling through a wholesaler, the wholesaler would pay the tax. But because there's this pending change in the law that would allow them to dispense, that's how you want to refer to giving samples, they would begin to become taxpayers and would start to need to file excise tax returns and pay tax on it. So that's why they've approached Representative Dabney and said, please treat us like the small brewers and like you're proposing to treat the small wineries.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know, maybe Mr. Michaels or I don't know who can answer it. I'm looking at the small winery credit at the same time I'm looking at the brewer's credit. And I'm curious why the winery, which in my mind, and I might be wrong, but I always thought wine would be a more expensive product. Their 50,000 gallons gets $104,000 credit, and the beer guys, looks like the first 50,000 barrels produced get the credit,
and their credit is $1,385,7500. What's the difference between those two maximum credits? Why is that? I don't understand why one would get so much more credit than the other one. What am I missing there?
Mr. Biggerstaff.
Madam Chair and Senator Scoy, the key difference is looking at the beer language, it's by barrel. And remember, that's a 31-gallon barrel, so the tax on a barrel of beer is roughly $25, I think, under the proposal, whereas on a gallon of wine, it's only $4, $2. So that's why there's such a drastic difference between them.
Madam Chair, Mr. Biggerstaff, because the – and then, so then the definition of a small brewery must be quite a bit larger than the definition of a small winery?
Mr. Biggerstaff?
Thinking about that right also then? I mean, per volume.
Madam Chair, and Senator Scoy, that would be correct because 200,000 barrels would be multiplied by 31 gallons,
sure.
So it would be a much higher production output.
Mm-hmm. Well, Madam Chair, I did have a chance to talk about the small winery credit with our expert in the Senate, and he told me that 100,000 gallons of wine is $500,000 bottles, which is a lot. Which he was looking at it thinking maybe we'd want to make those numbers a little smaller if you're truly looking at the small winery. But, you know, it was just conversation.
And I think if the Senate gets interested, we hope in this, you know, there's things that can, you know, Representative Dabney has the thing he's interested in. You know, there'll be more discussion, but we wanted to get the concept out there, and we know, like every other tax, there's pluses and minuses, and we understand that. So we appreciate the Senate learning about our proposal, and we thank you for going through it. And if everyone's okay with this, can people make it till 10 o'clock? Or everyone stay awake till 10? I'm kind of a night owl, so I have to ask, because a lot of people are not.
10 o'clock, I turn into a pumpkin.
Okay. Okay, so let's be done by 10. Can we work on, and I don't know if Ms. Jensen has the item from Mr. Michael, or if it already got handed out. There was a list.
No, they haven't.
And if we could get that, and maybe everyone can scan it, and we've got, you know, the Senate list. And think of, you know, are there some items we could get through real quick here?
We have a fix provision.
A fix?
A fix.
Fix of what? Senator Rust.
When we were adopting the TIF provisions, there was the one where it was the general law extension of for the jobs, and then the second paragraph was just getting rid of some obsolete language, and your article and section just had striking some obsolete language, and in our motions, we skipped over that.
Oh, okay, great.
So
can Ms. Pollack or can Mr. Silva, can someone tell us the motion that Senator Rust wants to make here to fix that? The inadvertent motion with the TIF thing. I'm not sure.
I can find it.
Or if anybody knows. Well, you've got this list. Is that it?
Yeah,
or is that little yellow post-it note when I saw you in the hall?
It was on my handwritten note.
Which is always the real list.
Article 9, section 3.
It would be Article 2. I would move, and then I'll show you. Article 9, section 3. In the House language, it's circled in pink.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you just
okay? So we moved to reconsider, right? Is that what we
never acted on?
Oh, we
that
never
month.
Acted
we
on
just,
it.
Because we weren't going to do the Senate right. bill, we didn't do the House bill, and we should have taken the House language, which just struck
look
the.
I got
gotcha.
You.
Look, it's on your list.
Oh, it's on Mr. Michael's list too. So
we just forgot to do that.
So Senator Rust, did you?
Yeah, I'll just move House Article 9, Section 3.
I don't see it on this list. I mean, I understand
page
it now.
Page 65 on the second page. On the second page.
Oh, there's a lot. Oh, yes.
It's about
okay, halfway through the second page.
Yeah.
Okay, discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries.
I don't have it, though.
Okay, so this...
I
under here.
And I think one of the best things we could do, because people are tired, is to ask Mr. Michael or anyone on House Research or Senate Council, do things jump out that are very, very simple that we should quickly go through that take almost no discussion? Does anybody see anything like that?
Like the one we just did.
Like the one we just did. Those are really nice.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
The motor vehicle repair paint. That's, I think, four times that's been in the tax bill. I think the provisions are very similar, except I believe the House language is preferable because of a reference that is incorrect in the Senate.
So it's on the second page of the Mr. Michael handout, and it's on the side-by-side, page 50 and 52. It says it's in the Senate bill.
It is a money raiser. You're right. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Templin.
Members of the committee, that provision is a revenue raiser in the House, and it reduces revenue in the Senate because of their base expansion.
Because in the Senate, one of our base broadeners was auto repairs, and then it comes under that. So if you don't mind.
Madam Chair, my apologies. I was going by the criteria of what do we have that's really similar.
Okay, well, what do we have that's
Marshall
easy
County,
and doesn't have anything
Marshall,
to do with money?
Marshall County Farmsteads. We would
Where's
take
that?
The House language, Article 4, Section 22.
Okay, so we're on the side-by-side, page 20, Marshall County Farmsteads. Senator Skoy moves. What did you
House
say?
House Bill, Article 4, Section 22.
House Article 4, Section 22.
And, Madam Chair.
Senator Rust.
Page 20 of the side-by-side.
Page 20 of the side-by-side.
A little bit more cautious than Senator Skoy, just to make sure that means that the homestead is extended until
the
natural life of the person is ended. Is that correct?
Getting the nods.
Right.
Okay. Just check.
Getting the nods on both sides. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
I'm opposed. Motion carries. So that one's adopted. Anyone else find anything? And, Senate and House staff, if you have ones you would offer up, that's particularly simple.
Do you want to try manufactured homes?
Is it cost money?
No.
Does it raise money?
Neither one of those.
Okay.
There are
a
different
differences.
Attitude toward them.
Yeah.
Is it simple or does it make our head hurt now?
Maybe if I can just tell you what I was thinking.
Is this Representative Purcell's bill by chance?
Yes.
Do you know?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know whose it is.
Okay.
Madam Chair, and maybe the staff, if they want to listen to this and see if they have an answer. My concern about what was proposed.
Oh, excuse me,
yep.
Mr. Chair. Your staff is wondering, what are you talking about? So we're on side-by-side, page 16, and it's the first one on the Mr. Michael list, manufactured homes. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My concern here is these are modular mobile homes that are going to be in a residential park next to a dealer that has inventory for sale. And my concern was that the issue is that they don't want to have to disconnect all the utilities in order to move these back into their inventory. I think I'm recalling this properly. My concern was that if somebody has had one of these homes for 12 or 15 years, that they would then foreclose on it and could just move it back into their inventory, and then it wouldn't be subject to the personal property tax. And am I recalling all of this right, Mr. Hines? I see you listening intently, or Nora Pollock, Ms. Pollock?
Mr. Hines?
I wonder if the department might.
Okay.
Mr. Hagan is here.
And Ms. Pollock, you want to hear from the department first?
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Mr. Sylvia.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, that's correct. I should note that if we do want to discuss this, there is a technical amendment that the department has recommended as part of some clarifying language.
Okay, so that amendment's coming around that we'll need if we're going to adopt this. And I don't know if someone can get it to Mr. Hagan or Ms. Von Mosch.
And
sorry, we,
Madam Chair.
Yes. if you want to confirm. Mr. Chair's question.
Sure, and Madam Chair, what my concern is I think that there should be a time limit or in some limit on the time that these things could have been in this park, that they wouldn't be able to go back into their inventory forever or at, after, you know, certainly a relatively long time, because they wouldn't be what you would be traditionally thinking of inventory. And so I don't know if that's something that can be addressed or not. We kind of struggled with it a little bit and never really came up with a real good solution. But that was my concern, and I think it's a valid concern. I don't want somebody to have their home foreclosed on and then the dealer just move it into inventory and start being exempt from the personal property tax.
Okay. Does you want to move your amendment so we get it in order you want?
Madam Chair, can I move the A61 amendment?
Okay, we all have it. Discussion. Yep. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The A61 amendment by Senator Scoy is adopted to this provision. Does the department want to tell us anything?
Madam Chair, our property tax division asked for the amendment that was just adopted,
okay,
just because it is more clear and we feel it would be make administration of this provision easier.
We're fine with this.
Sure. Okay. So move the Senate language. I'll move Article 2, Section 6 and 7 of the Senate bill.
Ms. Senator Scoy. I mean, Senator Rest.
Hard to tell us apart. We look so much the same.
I just want to make sure that in the Senate article, whatever, 2, Section 6, it says it adds a cross-reference to the definition of limited dealer. I just want to make sure that that's needed.
Mr. Hines?
Yes.
That would
be
yes, it is.
So that's why also the Senate language is preferable.
Preferable. Okay. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. So that's been adopted. Does Senate Council see anything particularly easy over there or House research?
I think we could do the Marshall local tax approval on page 2.
Page 2, Marshall local tax approval.
And then...
And that's page 62 of the side-by-side. Do we need Mr. Michael or who wants to tell us about that? It says, I don't see it in the Senate.
We don't have it.
Mr. Michael.
This was one of those instances
where
the city failed to file their local approval. Now, I know the Senate had some issues with the use of the lodging tax revenues that you were uncomfortable, I think, with the...
We did the Section 32.
Yes.
We approved...
Part of it.
The validation.
Oh, okay.
We did Sections 32 and 30.
One.
I don't have that
one. Part. And then we stopped because we knew Senator part. Scoy...
No, actually, we didn't. We did not do 30 and 31 because I think it was Mr. Hines that pointed out or someone that it was... By doing 32, if we didn't want to do 30, we could just be silent on 31. Did I get that right?
Mr. Chair, I thought she turned into a pumpkin at 10 o'clock. The fact that you were just recalling all that was amazing. I think that was very impressive. thank goodness someone cares about the details around here. Center Rest. Mr. Michael or Mr. Hines, I think we do need some. Yes, there was. I'm completely confused. So
I can recall the issue. The issue I had with regard to the lodging tax comes from the Bemidji provision. When we heard the Bemidji provision with regard to lodging tax in committee, the promotion people for the cities, what do you call those? Convention Bureau and Visitor Convention Center folks, they came and opposed the provision because Bemidji was proposing to use a lodging tax for something that traditionally was only used for promotion of the area. And so when I looked at the Marshall lodging tax revenue being utilized for their emergency response and training centers, I thought that perhaps we would be setting a precedent of using the lodging tax for non-promotional
It's for tour. The lodging tax is for tourism.
For tourism. And here,
that's not how they were using it.
And that's not how they're using it. So I didn't think we were going to do that. I see Ms. Pollack or Mr. Michael.
That was the
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, I think what you can do is, I know what you can do is approve Section 31 and Section 32 mm-hmm. and not make and not adopt yes, Section 30. Yes. And that will validate the prior laws, but will not extend the lodging tax to allow them to use it beyond what they can under current law. So basically, the reason I put it on the list was just to do those two provisions, but not to raise the Section 30.
Okay, well, this was not a good example of an easy one.
Mr. Michael, we
should have been
we had approved 32.
I don't have that on my sheet as having been approved.
Chair. It was on the list, and we had done 32.
Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair and members, there was a motion to adopt Section 32, but it was pointed out there that there may be some connection between 30, 31, and 32, and so we held off on adopting any of those.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Madam Chair, I would move House Article 8, Section 31 and 32.
Right.
Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. Other suggestions, Senate Council or House Research? Mr. Hines.
The on page 17 of the side-by-side House Article 4, Section 12, the electric generation personal property exemption.
Page 17. And they are the same?
The only difference is that the Senate requires local approval.
That's fine. Do we prefer local approval? Or you do not prefer local approval?
No.
Where is that? Page 17 on the side-by-side. In the House, it's Article 4, Section 12, and in the Senate, it's Article 2, Section 11. Only difference, Senate has local approval.
Oh, sure.
I know.
Thank you, Senator Madam Scott. Chair. Madam Chair, this was a floor amendment.
Oh.
And it came to the Senate author of the amendment, and he brought it to me, and I took a look at it, and I thought, well, yeah, we would want the locals to approve these by resolution. Unfortunately, we didn't understand that some of these smaller facilities, in order to go through their process, already have city approval. It's redundant, not needed, and so we think that the House language is preferable.
Okay, so Senator Scoy moves Article 4 of the House, Section 12. This is the electric generation facility personal property tax exemption on 17 of the side-by-side. Discussion? Everyone have that one? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The motion carries. Anything else people have to offer? Well, that's pretty bad if no one's got easy ones. What else
can... mean we're about done, huh?
Well, I wonder if some of these... Let's just look at them here now. Are on the Senate list, too.
Oh property Chair. Tax payments for military?
Well, Madam Chair...
Senator Rest, I think we need to think about
with
all
regard
this.
To
Senator Rest
on the bottom of the first page, that Metropolitan Fiscal Disparities Working Group.
Oh yes,
we think that can just be done informally by the chairs of the tax committee and the commissioner, and we don't think any motion needs to be made on that.
So we don't need that one.
Strike it.
Is everyone okay with that?
The bottom one.
Bottom, the Metropolitan Fiscal Disparities Working Group. The Senate had language. They think this department can do it. On the bottom here on
with
page 21. And so we're willing to not discuss further.
Yeah, no motion.
So we don't need that one. Okay, so cross that out. Others from anyone?
We're very close, Madam Chair, on 4D.
Really? I heard that you were close and then you blew up and then you're not close.
Well, it got closer and then. Someone who, you know, hadn't been part of the group of 30 said, oh, could we wait just a minute? So it's still out there. It's really, it's very interesting because I refuse to read the language. Just want them to get it done.
Exactly.
Madam Chair?
Representative Dabney.
I have a different understanding.
Oh.
See?
So it's definitely not ready then.
I guess, because I spoke with MHFA and other advocates today, and they're good on the language, the now 8 pages. Okay.
Well, I think Senator Rest is letting people know to work it out or forget it. Correct?
Right.
Representative Dabney and Senator Dietzick. Yes. I think that's fair that everybody needs to hurry up and get these things worked out or they're going to go away.
We'll try and get a talk
yes.
to you.
Right.
Okay, thank you, Chair Skoy.
And Madam Chair, I don't know if you want to consider this. It's a relatively small provision in the Senate bill that the House does not have. It's the expansion of authorized expenditures on local sales tax referenda. It's on the second page. It's Article 7, Section 49 of the Senate bill. Page 60 on the side-by-side.
Oh, yes. Page 60 of the side-by-side. Mr. Michael, I know Ms. Daltner is not here. Can you comment on this? I don't think this is – if she were here.
No.
Somebody – Ms. Manzi, could you channel Ms. Dalton for me for a moment and tell me what she'd say if
Madam
she were
Chair,
here?
I can. Ms. Dalton left us a note. And and it says – this is on page 60 of the side-by-side.
Okay.
Currently, the local government may only spend money to hold the referenda. This allows them to also spend money to provide facts and data on the proposed tax and to host public forums. No state cost.
Oh, is this the school districts?
Cities brought this to me. It's to
school districts can do educate it. Their
it's an education
their,
issue.
Their constituents, but cities can't.
Madam Chair. Schools. It's a League of Cities thing.
Madam Chair, as I understand it, currently local units of government, other than school districts, can only tell you that the referendum exists.
Exactly.
And can't describe for you
what it
content,
is.
Impact, things like that.
Like school districts can.
And what Ms. Dalton has assured me is that this simply parallels the authority that school districts have, I think, and the obligation to be unbiased in that information.
Okay, so is it fair to say that Representative Dabney moves?
Yes,
okay.
Certainly.
Article 7 of the Senate, Section 49, that's page 60 on the side-by-side. Senate Article 7, Section 49, discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion carries. Anything else people can find? How about those, the Article 9, Section 3, obsolete TIF language?
We did that one.
Yeah. That one's done?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's the, okay.
What about the, what about those other two TIF provisions? I don't even remember that.
Okay, the second.
In your Article 9?
The second page, Article 9, Section 4. So, and you might remember the Senate arrest, there was a former representative who became, I believe, a commissioner and a chief of staff at one point for a governor. I think it's Representative. I think in a TIF bill, this is how I remember it, he didn't like that Burnsville was buying some street lighting or park benches or something with TIF, and so he said you can't buy that stuff. And I think we're saying, it's okay to use TIF for that. And it had been used for that for a long time, and then it was taken out. And so I think that's what it is. Mr. Michael, can you clarify? Do I know what I'm talking about at all?
Madam Chair, you know what you're talking about.
So that's okay. So Representative McElroy, do you remember
Chair,
that?
I would move Article 9, Section 4 of the House.
Okay. On the rest motion, so we're going to let TIF be used for that again.
The beautification of the TIF district.
Yes, yes.
Lady Bird Johnson would appreciate it.
Yes, exactly. Okay, discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What was the motion?
Article 9, Section 4 of the House bill, which is page 65 of the side-by-side. Senator Rest, page 2. She is moving Article 9, Section 4 of the House bill. This is eliminating TIF prohibition on decorative and aesthetic purpose items. Discussion. Senator Senjum, you got it?
Yep.
Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. That's been adopted. Do you want to talk about the next TIF one?
No, I need more time.
Okay, that's, and just so you know, as you think about, that was to sort of get at some of these folks who got caught in when we went from the homestead credit to the exclusion, the way they lost the value.
I just want to go back and read it.
Okay, yes, yes, yes. You know, we have it in, just so you know, we have it in the Bloomington South Loop Mall of America, or the Bloomington Central Station, and I just thought carrying it, it seemed fair that other people in the same situation could get the same treatment. I think Mr. Michael has kind of gone through some of the projects, if you want to talk to him later. Okay, he thinks there's 13 or 14 across the state.
Understand.
Yeah, okay, great. Further. Yes, Senator Skoy has the assessor accreditation, page 16 of the side-by-side. And I think we had a good talk about that. And I just want to ask House Conferees. You know, we had, I don't know who all, which of the House Conferees are here. We heard the discussion on that one. That had been on your list. And we had Mr. Hagan talking about, you know, this how we'd get more assessors, receive more education, and get more folks kind of trying to assess things similarly. We had the ethanol issue in the House bill, but trying to get at sort of this system. And I personally think it's a good one. Representative Dabney, you've worked on this and seen the quandaries that are going on in the House or in the division of the property tax division. Did you feel okay with that? I thought that was a step forward for everybody, but, you know, yeah. So I'd be interested in doing that if you are, Representative Dabney.
You know, Madam Chair, I'm interested in more consistent assessment practices and outcomes across the state. I have heard from some assessors that this may cause some challenges, particularly in greater Minnesota, of getting people to getting the right level of qualification in the right spot at the right time. Just today I heard from a constituent who must be an assessor saying, whoa, hold it, there's some complications.
Senator Skoy, and I see we're getting language. Is this from you, Senator Skoy?
Yeah.
Can we move the, I'll move the A64 just to get this in the form you'd like it. So the A64 members, discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say aye. So that's now, we're going to discuss it now, but we want to get the Senate provision the way Senator Skoy wants it to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Chair Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Part of the issue that we've ran into, I actually had a much tighter time frame in the bill that the bill has in the Senate language. Part of the issue came that there are very few people that do the accreditation of assessors, and so they wanted a longer time period to get everybody to work through this. And so we've made some accommodations there. We've also reduced the first fine and done some other modifications to soften the language up. This is language that I've worked with the department on, and I think it's pretty well agreed upon by all the parties. I know that there might be some individual assessors that are a little bit concerned about this, but I think, in general, it will really help us as we try to bring uniformity to the assessing across the state.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, this looks like the same amendment you brought the other night that I had some concerns about.
This is the language that was worked on between the department and the Senate and the assessors. And did I present this before staff?
Madam Chair.
A-43.
Mr. Sylvia.
I was handed the
A-64.
Mr. Sylvia, and we've moved and adopted the A-64. If that was an error, please tell us.
No,
Mr.
Madam
Sylvia.
Chair, it is the A-64.
Okay.
And members, there's new language. I can point to you on line 1.9, after nonfeasance, all the way down to...
excuse me. I'm going to stop for just a second here. I'm sorry, Mr. Sylvia. We're going to pause. Members cannot find this, so I'm not sure what we're looking at. We may be we may have the wrong pieces of paper.
Yes, I do. My apologies.
Okay, sorry. Okay, we're good. Senator Rest, do you have it? I want to make sure everyone's got what she needs here.
Yes, I have A-64. I'm trying to figure out what the A-43 amendment
is. Do we have the old A-43, anybody?
We adopted the A-43 amendment. So we need
have conforming changes as part of the motion.
Really good, aren't I?
Yeah, impressive.
At 9:50.
So we have to
take away that I had that it's on hold.
It was like we put this on so that right. if we were going to adopt this section, this would be it. So we need to
direct the staff to make conforming changes.
A43 to go to the A64 if that's what we really want to be considering.
So, yes, we're trying to remember if we believe it was adopted.
Madam Chair, I can, if I may, it was adopted, and the issue became it was adopted, but because we don't have an updated engrossment and the page and line numbers would be off, I was talking to staff, and they thought it would be easier if we replaced Section 9, which was amended on the A43, with this new Section 9 incorporating the new language.
So I'm going to withdraw my A64 motion. That's before us. Does that work?
Madam Chair,
and then we can reconsider this? Take it off?
They're shaking no. I think I just heard Mr. Sylvia say that because this replaces the amended Section 9, this the A64 amendment motion is proper.
Okay. Then I didn't withdraw my A64 motion.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, so this section now is Section 8 and a Section 9? The two go together.
Mr. Sylvia.
Madam Chair, the A43 amendment added two sections. The Section 9 dealing with the assessor fines and dismissals, this is the new Section 9 replacing the Section 9 on the A43, but because there wasn't an engrossment, we had to delete Section 9 and the new Section 9 on the A64 would replace that.
And the A43 amendment, are lines 1-4 through 1-8 still part of the proposal?
That's correct, Madam Chair, Senator Rest.
Thank you. Okay, so everything is properly before us or not?
Yes.
Okay, so now Representative Dabney still has a concern with the A64. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. This is the same concern that I raised, I think, on the A43 amendment. Looking at line 1, or page 1, line 5 of the A64 there at the end, it still provides the Commissioner of Revenue with the ability to direct the State Board of Assessors to discipline someone.
That's the issue.
And my concern being, next year the Department of Education comes in asking for the same authority over the Board of teachers and administrators, and the year after that it's the Commissioner of Health coming in for cosmetologists and the nursing boards and so on. And I remain very concerned about that.
Mr. Chair, your thoughts, because I think this is something you want to get done, and is there maybe Mr. Sure. Hagan can accommodate?
And Madam Chair, if I could just say the reason for we were trying to give the department some authority to ensure uniformity for assessing, and that's the effort. And I wonder if Mr. Hagan would
be wise
to
Hagan.
Talk about this.
Because we, I think we're really close here, but we have some concern on the House side still. Mr. Hagan.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy and Representative Dabney. The direct language does, as it states, give the commissioner the authority to direct the board to, in cases of the identified cases, revoked license. And this is not entirely unprecedented. There's provisions for revoking licenses in case of failure to pay child support for a licensed individual, or in the case of failing to file or pay income tax, where they don't. It's not at the discretion of the board. If the act is determined by the appropriate commissioner, they do revoke the license in instances like that. So it has existed before, if you will.
Senator Scully.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, I mean, if you want to hold and think about this, I guess we can. I think it's been worked out pretty well between the department and the assessors and stuff, but I don't,
Representative Dabney, are you looking for, I'm just trying to think this one, is there some kind of comfort language in your mind that would work, or because if we could come up with it, maybe we'd be done with this, but I'm just not sure how to get around this.
Well, Madam Chair, kind of flying by the seat of my pants here, is if the desire of the author and of the department is for greater rigor in the penalties available for assessors who are not carrying out their professional duties to a level that is needed. Could we, instead of empowering the commissioner, and I would still argue the precedent, the language that Mr. Hagan that you identified aside, breaching the authority of a professional board, could we simply upgrade the authority of the professional board in terms of the penalties that they could levy? The commissioner is, I assume, at all times free to identify that, you know, Jim Davney is a lousy assessor, and by strengthening then the penalties available to the Board of Assessors, they can slap me, as opposed to breaching the wall of the integrity of the professional board, which is my concern.
Mr. Hagan.
Madam Chair, Representative Davney, that certainly could be done. I do have concerns about the ability of the state board to follow through in a timely manner on some of these issues. The state board is a kind of a unique board in that it's housed within the Department of Revenue, although it has no relationship with the Department of Revenue. It has very little paid staff. It's got a clerical person who's primarily a paid staff. They have no investigators. They don't have, and they just have had a hard time in the past dealing with issues of discipline where it gets involved in a long and extended process, going back and forth with for a variety of reasons. These instances where they've tried to deal with an agreed needed level of discipline have drug on for months and months and months, and oftentimes not reached what many would believe to be a good resolution.
Representative Benson.
Would it be possible have the State Board of Assessors recommend or advise the commissioner that there are problems, and then the commissioner's staff could do the research, and so?
Mr. Hagan?
That way they would have some independence.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the State Board doesn't really have the ability to do investigations or research issues like this. It's sort of
that's my point.
I'm sorry.
They would recommend to the Commissioner of Revenue that there is a problem, which then the Commissioner would assign members of his or her staff to do the research.
Chair Sklay.
And, Madam Chair, maybe we'll have to hold on this for another evening, but I just, because so many times Green Acres gets brought up in a negative light and not having any reason for me to move forward, but Green Acres was an area where we had county assessors across the state. Yes. We had 43 of them that refused to implement a statewide law, and we had no recourse, and they just refused. And so we're trying to figure out a way to kind of gently move things towards more uniformity, and we need to have somebody that when things don't go the way the state statute requires, can go in and move things in the right direction.
And I agree with that. I if we want to go till maybe we can bring this up tomorrow, and maybe some language can get worked on. Because I remember helping Representative Otremba try to get people that she was saying deserve these tax treatments, and assessors saying nope. And that's, we don't want that going on. So I think we can take another shot at it.
We have one more.
I see a couple too. So Representative or Senator Rust.
On page 87, Article 12, Section 17. The only difference is you have a section that allows those street reconstruction bonds to be used for bituminous overlay projects, and we would accept the House language.
Okay, so Senator Rust on page 87 of the side-by-side moves Article 12 of the House, Section 17. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion carries. And Representative Davney.
Ma'am, I'd like to move Madam Chair, let's see if I can find it here.
It's on the bottom of this, and we should have grabbed Senator Skoy, but I talked to him.
Article 4, okay, Section 23, the House Bill Entertainment Facilities Coordination.
Yes. Page 20 of the side-by-side.
We like that.
Article 4, Section 23, this is Minneapolis, St. Paul.
We think that's really a fine suggestion for maximizing the use of the two facilities and coordinating and being more collaborative than competitive and when it gets to the bottom line, which is what both of them want, and they've both been used against one another.
Senator.
So that's on page 20?
Right. Senator Dietzick.
Ready?
Chair, there should be an amendment that clarifies some of this language, which may mean we have to come back to it tomorrow.
Okay, we'll take it. We can take it up.
Okay.
I don't believe I have it on me.
Okay, so I guess we'll just go to tomorrow.
We do want to amend the language.
Okay. We can do that tomorrow if we don't have it here.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Rest.
Page 2021, we're still waiting for the language from the department on the biofuels assessment moratorium and study language. We wonder, we've asked for that some time ago now.
Ms. Von Mosch?
Is it ready?
Biofuels assessment moratorium and study language, waiting for DOR input. DOR, we want your input.
Madam Chair, I'll defer to Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Cummings.
Madam Chairs, we have been meeting with members of MAAO and also the biofuel industry, and we have language, and we think it's done. Everyone is just doing the final look through to make sure that everything's okay. So you should have that language by tomorrow or Monday.
Okay. We're going to call on you, Mr. Cummings, tomorrow.
Senator Rest said under her breath, it sounds like 4D.
It does.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Okay, so that's a wait one. I think we're running out of ones to do.
I think we're
done. Mr. Michael, or does anyone?
How about Madam Chair?
Senator Rest.
We both heard proposals regarding property tax payment dates and delinquent property taxes for active duty military folks, and we couldn't find a solution to that that didn't
18 of the side by side
that didn't either publicly require the person's name to be disclosed, and we weren't trying to cause any embarrassment, but it seemed that we couldn't see our way a solution to that, and wondered how you solve that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Madam
or
Chair.
Didn't find it to be a problem that we did.
Well, Madam Chair, you're correct. Some folks brought to me after we had adopted the division report the concern that the April 15th date doesn't work because by sometime in March, they need to publicly identify
the people, right.
The people who are at that point in arrears on their property taxes, and that is a bad thing. I don't know if we can. The proposal allows the active duty individual 6 months grace period. I don't know if it's as simple as giving them 4 months grace period and saying we're cutting you some space here. We're just not giving you an obvious number.
Does your proposal keep their name out of the paper? Or wherever.
Miss Manzi or Mr. Hines or Mr. Biggerstaff.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, that was certainly the intent of it, and we did hear those issues with it. I can't say that this provision was in some ways mirroring federal law, which and there's other parts of Minnesota statutes that deal with military service and property type issues which require the sheriff to inquire if a property owner is on military orders.
Right.
So it's not, there are other areas in the law where it's not so cut and dry and as far as keeping their names out of the paper. The intent was to stop that process, but it may not work that way.
Could we just think about that maybe overnight and perhaps, it for the active duty military person, they would say, my name in the paper? No problem. Yes. if that's going to, you know, help them avoid the delinquent payment, but mm-hmm. maybe we could just take a little bit longer look at that tomorrow and okay. and make a judgment about what's a benefit as opposed to the exposure.
Okay, and I think we should stop. And I think it's worth noting what I see still on the list is this assessor accreditation issue, which we hope people are going to go work on, holding exempt property for economic development. We've got this pollution control personal property tax exemption, 4D, conservation easements, modifying the ag homestead requirements. We've talked about a lot of these, but we've got to make some decisions. The active duty military, you know, is your name published issue was just raised. Special assessments on state-owned property, the biofuels thing, we want that worked out.
Those are all ones that we brought up, I think, the yep. first night.
Yep, angel credit, minor technical change. I think that one will be easy. The targeting more to greater Minnesota, we'll have to think about that. Lease-to-own used motor vehicles, just so people who have been sitting here know what list we're looking at. Bemidji's local food and beverage, Rochester sales tax sharing, adjusting original net tax capacity for TIF districts with large reductions. Oh, we talked about that due to market value. Labor peace requirement, minerals taxation. I would request we don't do anything in that tomorrow. Representative Ansels asked if we could not sure. do anything. The House has municipal street improvement. We've got the public finance piece at the Metropolitan Airports Commission, the 9/11 fee provisions, and then petroleum taxes. And then on the Senate one, some of those were mentioned. There's bingo halls, raffle limits, MA dental, data centers, critical access dental, the soil repair TIF that we've talked about, tax court payments. And I see on this list Waban Ojima MMB fix.
Didn't we already adopt that and make fun of the spelling error?
There's a fix to it that's coming tomorrow.
We just made fun of the spelling error.
Okay.
Ms.
McQuay.
Madam Chair and Senator Dabney, or Representative Dabney, we did adopt the language on the Waban Ogama.
I thought we did.
I think White Earth School District language. However, we did receive language from MMB that they would like an update.
Okay.
So we need to go back and look at that. We received their language late.
So those are the total lists between all the lists that people have that we know of right now. Senator Rust.
Madam Chair and Ms. McQuay, was that the issue that was going to require a supermajority vote?
Ms. McQuay, does that require something else? Okay. Senator Rest, what are we doing tomorrow?
10 o'clock.
10 o'clock? Mm-hmm. And then we've got these other things you want us to know about that might come up?
We might take a look at the corporate provisions that both of us
okay.
have. And,
okay.
I mean, they're mostly the same, but there are a couple of wrinkles different, and we
yes.
can explore the differences.
Excellent. Thank you all. Sorry it's late and hot in the room. Good night, and we're adjourned.